Good evening. It's warm. Warm evening, warm summer night. So we went over number 15 last week in a hurry. So I thought if you have any more questions about it, that this would be the time to bring it up before we go into number 16. If you remember, it's about the Dharma teaching, which is for the benefit of all beings, so that beings who are still clinging to the sense of self can't hear it. But those who says wherever the sutra is honored, is explained, that place shall be honored. Inconceivable and incomparable is this Dharma teaching. For the benefit of those beings who set forth on the foremost of paths, for the benefit of those beings who set forth on the best of paths. So this is another aspect of the turning from the self-cultivation to the cultivation of self for the benefit of others. The arhats, the early Buddhists developed a very intense practice which was about achieving enlightenment and then being gone. So it was all about individual practice for the sake of the individual person. And it was about eliminating greed, hate, and delusion, wiping it out. And if you read the Theravadin texts, many of them are about that, how you root out greed, hatred, and delusion from your psyche. Sometimes it's very, very intense. So this wisdom teaching, this new wisdom teaching, it's very different from that. It begins to turn and notice that there are other people around, and that what Buddha meant was about others, and Buddha's life was devoted to others, to opening what Uchiyama Roshi called the hand of thought, opening people's minds to their own Buddha nature. Yes.
And when is the Dhamma Sutra before or thought to be before or after the Lama Sutra?
I don't remember.
It's just so...
They belong together.
The key themes in the reading.
Yes. All the Prajnaparamita material is like that. All of it. It isn't so complicated. So, in a way, it's we talk and talk about it, but it's not a very complicated subject, really. even though we have a huge fat book to carry around. Sally?
Forgive me if you've already covered this, but being the historian, I'm wondering if you could tell me when this was put forth.
I'll have to look it up. I never remember numbers.
Is it in here?
Oh, actually, I don't think it is. Oh, 1250. No, that's the number of beak shoots. I'm sorry. That's not it. No, it's earlier than that. It's earlier. Earlier. It's around the turn of the... I don't know how I would find it in here.
I'm just curious in terms of an historical context.
Of course.
43, it talks about, it says that Buddha's enlightenment is also occurred in 42.
Here it is.
So this is your Buddha that spoke about 43 before the common era.
Translated into Chinese 5 times between 403 and 703. And a 6th time in 663 as part of Sun Tzu's translation of the Mahaprajnaparamita Sutra. This is on page 445 in the glossary. So it's somewhere around the 300 or 400s.
So this would have been hundreds of years after Buddha's death.
Yes. 700 years or so. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. It's a radical change from the original teaching. Although the original teaching is a big part of it. It went off in a very different direction.
So then is this the beginning of the break between Theravada and Mahayana Buddhism?
Yes. In a large way, there were breaks all the time. From the very minute that Buddha died, they were separating themselves into little different sanghas and arguing with each other about what Buddha really said and what the right way to do it was and all of those things. So, and they became different schools and different teachings within the schools with their different understandings. So this is a reflection of all of that in the widest and the most compassionate way. And instead of arguing, it's just opening the whole thing up for people, which is refreshing.
In Musang's book on the Diamond Sutra, there's quite a bit of history or sort of discussion of that period, between Buddha's death and the Diamond Sutra. I found it very complex but really interesting. I don't think I was able to. I couldn't give you a haiku version of it. It sort of went over my head.
Right. I've read it a number of times, but I would have to go back and really make a study of it to be able to talk about it.
But I'd be happy to loan it to you if you'd like to just take a look at that section that talks about that period.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Sally. Well, number 16 is a short one, and it's about karma, which is everybody's favorite subject when you start diving into this, and seems like might be a good idea to explore it a bit. Somebody want to read?
Sure.
Thank you. Uh-oh.
Okay. Nevertheless, Subhuti, the noble son or daughter who grasps, memorizes, recites, and masters such a sutra as this, and contemplates it thoroughly, and explains it in detail to others, will suffer their contempt, their utter contempt. And how could this be? Subhuti, the bad karma created by these beings in their past lives should result in an unfortunate rebirth. But now, by suffering such contempt, they put an end to the bad karma of their past lives and attain the enlightenment of Buddhas. Subhuti, I recall in the past, during the countless infinite kalpas before the Daikankara, Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one, I served 8,400,000 million trillion other Buddhas and served them without fail. Nevertheless, Subhuti, although I served those Buddhas and Bhagavans and served them without fail, in the future, in the final epoch, in the final period, in the final 500 years of the Dharma-ending age, the body of merit of the person who grasps, memorizes, recites, and masters such a sutra as this, and explains it in detail to others, will exceed my former body of merit, not by 100-fold or 1,000-fold or 100,000-fold or 1,000,000-fold or 100,000,000-fold or 1,000,000,000-fold. Is this the dip reduction off or something? Or an amount that cannot be measured, calculated, illustrated, characterized, or even imagined, period. Subhuti, if I were to describe this noble son of God's body of merit, the full extent of the body of merit this noble son or daughter would thereby produce and obtain, it would bewilder or disturb people's minds. Furthermore, Subhuti, inconceivable and incomparable is this Dharma teaching spoken by the Tathagata, and inconceivable is the result we should expect.
So, you can see this is a bit radical. In fact, the Buddha himself is putting himself at the bottom of the list. If we're able to do this, then it's even more merit than he ever attained by doing all of that. That's how much merit comes. How do you express more or much? Hundreds and thousands and millions and jillions and quadrillions and body of merit, more than can be even imagined. So, this is a curious little place where it gives us a reality check that if we get abused in our practice, that if we suffer contempt, utter contempt in our practice, that it's our past karma that created that, and that this is our opportunity to be free of it. It's not that we shouldn't be abused, but that the abuse itself is freeing us of our bad karma. Now, karma is a very, very ancient idea, belief, part of several belief systems. There are many different ways of understanding it, including rebirth, In our practice, in the Soto Zen tradition, even in our practice, there are different beliefs about rebirth and about karma. Before we take the precepts, the very first thing we say is we admit our ancient twisted karma. So there's some recognition of the forces that have come together to create each thing, including each one of us. There are infinite number of causes and conditions that come to create every single tiny moment that we spent, that we live. And so we can't talk about my karma and your karma in the way that some people do, because there's no way to really know what it is. The past and the future are all a part of the present. It's not separate. And yet the present is the only place where we can act. And so even though perhaps we don't believe in karma in the old-fashioned way of being a fate, it is, and it means act, actually. It means to make or to do. And so it's about how we enact our life in the moment, which comes from the past and is an integral part of the future, and over which we actually have some control. So it's an extremely important point. We can look back into our life, we can look back seven generations, they say, and identify some of the forces that formed our family and thus our life, our country, the situation in the whole world, how those things have changed vast populations of people, and the end result in an amazing way is that each one of us got here somehow. So that's our karma. Our education certainly is, our immediate family and how we were affected by everyone who ever had anything to do with us. We take it all in. We're sponges in a way and become all of those things. So all of those things can become our karma. Our practice is to begin to become extremely familiar with it, as familiar as we can with how we came to be like this. Because our knowledge, our ability to see our life, gives us the power to act and enact it. Not figure it out, not do a psychological insight so much as free ourselves from our conditioning, free ourselves from our assumptions and the judgments that were imposed on us without our actually having considered them ourselves. We're full of those things and are constantly filled with those things because we're encountering our life, and we're getting people's opinions all the time, and we're constantly being informed. And if we're not careful, we just begin to believe everything that we hear and see. And that's a life of ignorance. And it's a painful life because we keep bumping into how things aren't working the way we think they ought to. Things don't work the way we think they ought to. They work the way they do. So karma also refers to the consequences of a deed, which is why it's so important how we behave. We talk about body, speech, and mind. How we use this instrument, you could say, that what we do affects what happens next. And of course, some of it is, most of it, we can't help. I mean, we know that. We know that some tiny thing can change everything in a way that you look back and you think, oh my goodness, if only we hadn't done that, that, and that. So it's not that we have infinite power over what's going to happen. It's not like that. And it's not like we're helpless because we're driven by the fates of our karma. It's not like that either. It's that we work in the flow of the dynamics of everything that's happening, as awake as we can be to what's really happening, not what we think is happening. Dogen was very, very strong about this subject of action, about acting. He said, we are. We're not, as the Diamond Sutra says, we're not really people, we are action. We are beings enacting life itself. Or we're life enacting being. It's both. And so study and insight and sitting all become extremely important in this practice of becoming aware of the depth and the flow of life. According to Buddhists, says Red Pine, karma originates from any action of the body, mouth, or the mind. The collective force of these three over the course of our most recent lifetimes, seven of them, accounts for our present condition. However, we are free to change our karma by creating new karma, or to transform it by seeing it for what it is, namely, delusion, without any nature of its own that it is itself the result of other delusions. So it's just one more cheap idea in the end. That we cultivate. So he says, thus, while Shravakas seek to bring karma to an end by bringing anger and desire to an end, bodhisattvas do so by bringing delusion to an end. So, so that's about karma. The other thing about this is about merit again. The full extent of the body of merit of this noble son or daughter would thereby produce and obtain would bewilder or disturb people's minds. And so Red Pine goes into or brings up Huineng's discussion about the difference between merit and blessings. And it's an important point that where Huineng said, you cannot confuse blessings with merit. Merit is present in the Dharma body, not in cultivating blessings. Merit is present in your own nature. It can't be obtained through donations and worship. So we talk about merit as if it were getting gold stars or something, you know, becoming teacher's pet or getting better at something. But it's not that. It's about our own nature. It's about how we become empowered by opening ourselves to others. And then as we become empowered, we give it away. The blessings are like Emperor Wu in the famous story with Bodhidharma. When he asked Bodhidharma about his merit, he said, how much merit did I get for building all these temples? And I gave all this money and all these jewels and everything for the sake of the Dharma. Did I get a lot of merit? And Bodhidharma said, no merit. There's no merit in any of that. You get blessings. People are all very happy. It's wonderful. But merit comes from a different place. Merit comes from inside. So when he talks about the son and daughter, the extent of the body of merit, it's just about that one simple thing. So Sheng Yi says something that sounds like it's right out of the Heart Sutra that we just chanted. Sheng Yi says, the meaning of this sutra, no dharma has a beginning, nor does prajna have a beginning. No dharma has an appearance, nor does prajna have an appearance. No dharma has an end, nor does prajna have an end. No dharma has duration, nor does prajna have duration. No dharma has a self, nor does prajna have a self. The nature of all dharmas is empty, and the nature of prajna is empty. Is inconceivable the meaning of this sutra. From such meaning, inconceivable meaning, comes our practice. Practice is the cause. Enlightenment is the result. Enlightenment includes an infinite body of merit. Thus, the result is also inconceivable. Which means unthinkable. Which means we don't try to grasp it. We can't try to own it in any way. It's way too big. All we can do is practice it, enact it, live it, be it. So it means being very well attuned and very well awake and very willing to be where we are and who we are. Just this, nothing special. That's the whole thing. Chao Ming calls this chapter the capacity to wash away karmic obstructions. I didn't leave time for questions. Are there questions? Anyway?
Well, Andy, I could probably answer this with what you said about being a team, but when you say about karma that it's not what we think it is, it's what it really is. That's just the question of becoming more attuned. Is that what you think?
Mm-hmm. More aware and more accepting. Mm. And I think that's what he means by when we become reviled and abused, that we earned it somehow. That who knows whether we earned it or not, but in any case, that's the truth of a situation. So then we can either ignore it and pretend and make up a story and create a whole jumble of mess, or we can turn around and face it and be clear and honest about it so that it becomes not a karmic force that's jamming us and pushing us, but that we're actually working with it.
I think that what I was thinking about was reactivity to when something negative happens, that kind of tightening up and kind of resisting it.
Mm-hmm.
That causes a whole other set of karmic of actions and reactions.
It does. Just
keeps, so if I guess if I could only just stay with whatever's happening.
Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard. Our emotions are usually ready to leap at any moment, so it's tricky. But it takes study, really studying how we are about things and becoming more familiar with our own nature. Ah, thank you. Good question.